You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So, hello Kishla.
Kia ora.
What have we got on newly identified marine species this week?
Well, I learned last week the 19th of March is World Taxonomist Appreciation Day. And so taxonomists are the scientists who discover and describe new species. And what this leads to marine species is that there's an organisation called the World Register of Marine Species, or WORMS, which I quite like that acronym. And so to celebrate World Taxonomist Appreciation Day, they published a top 10 newly described species for the year. And so in 2023, they released their list last week, and there was a New Zealand feature on it. So the planet, it's 70% ocean, largely unexplored. So there's a lot of new species that come out each year from that are marine. Average is about 2,000 new species a year. Last year, there were just under 2,000, and 330 of these were fossil species. And so New Zealand's a great place for marine fossils and finding them, particularly penguins and whales and dolphins and things like this. So last year, a new type of giant penguin was described out of New Zealand. Its common name is Fordyce's giant penguin. And this is, Ewan Fordyce was a professor at the University of Otago, a paleontologist there many years, who sadly died towards the end of last year, and so the researchers that described this fossil named it after him. And it was a whopper. It was predicted to have been about 150 kilos.
Jeez.
Now, for context, the emperor penguin, which is the current largest living penguin, is about 22 to 45 kilos.
Oh, that thing's huge.
Yeah. So you can imagine these penguins were massive. And this penguin lived about 60 million years ago. Its biological name is Kumimanu Fordycei. Yeah, it's really interesting in penguins. About 28 million years ago, the large ones just kind of disappear from the record, and we're left with what we have today, which, you know, from the really small little blue penguins up to the emperors. But yeah, they used to be massive. And so this fossil made it to this top 10 list, which I think justifiably so, because it's pretty cool. There were a few other things that were very cool. There was a jellyfish called St. George's Cross Medusa, and the reason it got that name is that its stomach is a red cross shape. So check it out online. There's a really cool picture of it. It was also really interesting in that someone first saw it in 2002, and then they've not found it again to 2022. So that's why it was only described and in the literature last year. There was a Samoan nautilus, which the nautilus are kind of like those spiral sort of shaped, and then they project themselves through the water by basically shooting out the open end kind of water. And then the other one that I'll mention that gets an honorary mention is the Henan's pygmy squid. And I love this because it's less than a centimeter in size. Like, it's tiny. And the way that it kind of made itself known to the world was there'd be recreational divers, and it would basically swim up towards their torches. Like, it's basically attracted to the light sort of thing. And they, as they described it, it would strike a pose. It would use its tentacles to make a little circle and stuff. And so they obviously were able to describe this. Sorry, there's one more honourable mention. There's the pictures are very cool. So check it out online. Worms, top 10, 2023 marine species. It's called a Bifrost pneumaterian. And it's basically this ribbon worm. And depending on the lighting and the individual, it's kind of blue to black, but then it's got like blue, green, orange, yellow stripes and spots. So it's this phenomenal colouring, and it's basically, it's the, you know, the warning system of nature. If I'm really brightly coloured, you probably don't want to eat me because I'm likely to have toxins, right? Yeah.
And that Worms top 10 list, that'll be linked in the Dear Science podcast later on today when that comes out. Moving on to the preservation of brain tissue.
Yeah, now this was really interesting. So it turns out you can actually find remains of like the brain, and it's still soft tissue. It hasn't been replaced by rock or something. So a lot of what we know in geological time, so long back, of soft tissue, it's like when the soft tissue there's a mold of it made by the surrounding rock, or, you know, there's some other process. But every so often you actually, not deep into time, but like 12, 13,000 years ago, you can still find soft tissue. And they find brains, which is really, it's counterintuitive in a way. Like, so in forensics, they would often say general rule of thumb is the brain is one of the first organs to degrade.
Right.
But you can, every so often, you'll find people will do archaeological digs and they'll find these soft tissue, still preserved brains. And so what this group in the UK did was they were like, we know this happens. There's been some sort of surveys about how often does this happen, but we're going to, like, they decided to go fully in depth. So they looked at source material from around the world, 10 different languages sort of thing, to figure out, you know, how many of these things are kind of around. In their survey, they uncovered 20 times more than there was previously in the previous survey. Mm. So they, because they've gone to a wider range of sources, they've been able to identify more. And they found there's records of just over 4,400 of these preserved human brains from 213 different sites around the world. These sites included an Iranian salt mine from 500 BC, a lake bed from Stone Age Sweden, and summit of Andean volcanoes from the Incan Empire. So, you know, all around the world, different times. But what was really, really interesting was 1,300 of these brains could be as old as 12,000 years old. Now, that's just phenomenal, right? Like, how does this happen? And so what they've done is they've then kind of analysed the climate data from these areas at about the time of what we know, and they've identified that there's probably five different mechanisms by which preservation occurs. So dehydration, you know, you remove all the water so it's less likely to rot. We know this, like, from preservation of food, right? You dehydrate. Freezing, again, we know this, you know, if you freeze something, you know, you've probably seen the pictures, can't remember what the specimen's called, but, you know, of people that have been in glaciers and died and their bodies are quite well preserved. Saponification and tanning, these are more chemical processes where there's a change in the chemistry. And then the fifth one, which is the one that we don't really understand, that they think is associated with the chemicals in the brain, cross-linking and metals. This is the one that lets you find these really old brains. And they're basically, this is why this is exciting to them, is it's basically a chemical treasure trove for them, right? Like, you can now have these bioarchaeologists go and start studying this brain tissue and learn more about evolution of disease and stuff like this.
Yeah, and then moving on to this last one, I had a little bit of a look. It was kind of creepy, I guess, with this genetically modified cow's milk.
It is a bit weird. It's a proof of concept study at the moment, so we're not going to have herds of genetically modified cows. And in New Zealand, like, doing New Zealand genetically modified research is very strictly controlled. So this happened in Brazil, and it's probably very strictly controlled in Brazil as well. I'm not making any comment on the law. I'm just saying you're not going to get genetically modified cows out in your paddock. But what they were interested in is basically, you know, cows produce milk. It's got a lot of protein. Like, the mammary gland is a great sort of protein factory, you know, for making proteins that we want. Diabetes is this disease that we know is on the increase. We know that we treat it with insulin, which is a protein. So what this group wanted to see was, could they use cows to basically, as a way of preparing human insulin that people could then use as a pharmaceutical?
Right.
So to do this, yeah, they genetically modified the cows. They did it in such a way that it was kind of only modifying the mammary cells. So they basically got this cow to produce human insulin, but it was only in its kind of milk and its mammary tissue. It wasn't through its body. And don't ask me the details of how you make that happen. I know the term lentivirus was in there as a vector. But what was really cool was, or interesting in a way, is that they were aiming to produce what's called proinsulin in the milk, and then proinsulin is like the precursor to insulin. But then when they milked their cow, they only managed to have one cow. They were aiming for 10 and only one got to producing milk.
Right.
They actually found that there was a lot of human insulin just in the milk. So there was three times as much as the proinsulin, which they hadn't expected. So the changes that you need to happen to the proinsulin to make insulin was actually happening in the cow's milk. Now, this is, I will say, this is totally, again, proof of concept. It's not, they didn't extract it to then injected into anyone. They were just showing it was there, and it's very at the early stages, but their philosophy behind the study in a way was that cows produce a lot of milk, right? So if you can have a small herd that's well controlled, you can, I think it was like, if you produce 1 gram of insulin per litre of milk, that's actually equivalent to about 29,000 units of insulin.
Jeez.
Yeah, what I found as a very general rule of thumb, so obviously everyone's case is different, how much insulin you need is different, but as a general rule of thumb, daily insulin, it's like body weight divided by 4. So that's kind of giving you an idea of, there's a lot of units of insulin, and that's 1 litre. A cow produces about 50 litres of milk a day.
Wow.
So you can see, like, the kind of idea was you could have a small herd that's basically giving enough insulin for a country, which could be really useful.
Yeah, that's incredible. All right. Thank you, Krishla, for coming in this week. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Swampy by Dry Cleaning.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.